Hey.
Michael, is that you?
Yeah.
Hi.
That's
Okay.
weird. My disk doesn't want to is spinning up to 100%. I don't know why. It does that every now and then.
Wow, that's weird.
Yeah.
Everything working okay again, though, or?
Yeah, but your recorder should still be going on. I tested mine real quick. That's why it took so damn long. Plus my machine doesn't boot all that fast.
I slowed the recording, I slowed it down. So it sound, no. I switched it off because we talked for a while, but I started drifting off, so
Oh, okay.
it wasn't exactly riveting podcasting material. We weren't really talking about comics or anything. We're just
But
talking
are
about,
you recording now?
yeah, I started up again.
Okay, cool. 'Cause
So
I'm recording too, so
we can piece something
we're
together.
back. Yeah.
If you're
I was just telling them all about my
puppy and her surgery.
What does she have surgery for? Spayed or neutered or what?
No, for her kneecap, because she had a kneecap that kept going out of socket or out of joint or whatever you want to call it. I guess they said it's pretty common. Although I never had a dog or heard of a dog that had it before. So,
No, I
you know.
haven't heard of it either. I've heard of
No.
me that happening to me, but I haven't heard it in the dog.
We noticed in the late summer that all of a sudden, like out of nowhere, she would start hopping on three legs, and then 2 seconds later, she'd be fine. And then it started happening more and more, and then we discovered that that's what it was. And
You know,
long story short, we went to our original vet, and they wanted an astronomical figure for the surgery. We got recommendations for a vet that a ton of people seemed to love. We went there. We loved them too. They did the surgery. It was less than half the cost than my first vet.
is everything okay though? Everything went
Yep.
well?
Everything went 100%. She still has her cone because she has her stitches through Friday.
Yeah, she'll want to
And
lick them or pull them out, that's for
pull them
sure.
out. Yep. And then we can get rid of that on Friday. And yeah, I mean she had a checkup yesterday. They do some sort of laser therapy 4 times. So
Yeah.
she went for her first one, and the vet was surprised that she was already putting any weight at all on the knee that they did the surgery on. But yeah, she's doing great. They said that she's really, really a lot faster than what like the average is in terms of
Right.
recuperation. Yeah, but
Well,
she's so young
that
too, so they knew
actually
it would be a little
did
faster.
happen. That actually did happen to Harley, where she pulled something like in her shoulder and she had a wicked limp.
Yeah.
It happened when Barb was on took a vacation and I couldn't go. I had to stay and work. And it was worrying me because she couldn't jump on the couch, she couldn't jump into the car 'cause I take Harley for rides and stuff. And she was just having a hard time. But I gave her some Rimadyl, and like after a day or two, she was back to normal. But it sure looked like something was like out of its socket, you know, like her
Yeah, could have
shoulder
been.
was
Yeah.
dislocated. It's a little different, but when you get
Yeah.
a
No,
dislocation, you could pop back in, you know.
and that's the thing. They said at first, like with anti-inflammatory, maybe it would pop back in,
Yeah.
but it didn't. And they checked, and they're like, yeah, it's like a. I was telling Chris, there's like four levels of degree, and
Yeah.
four is the worst. But they said she was probably at a two. So it wasn't like horrible, but it was something that was never going to get. They came right out like it's never going to get better all by itself. And the
And how's
surgery is close to 100% effective. So,
yeah, laser, right?
yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she's doing great. So she's doing awesome. And Chris, I didn't tell you, but I want to tell you guys, you're the first people outside of our family to know that we now have a kitten as
Oh,
well.
wow.
Yeah.
We do too.
You have a kitten?
Well, there's a kitten, a cat that, hey, it's more like a bobcat, but I don't know. He's huge. He's a huge kitten. He hangs out in our backyard right underneath the birds.
Well, we We went yesterday. We got her, and we briefly last night just introduced the dog and the cat. And the one good thing is the dog is very happily excited, not predatorily excited. So worst case scenario, the cat will just not want anything to do with the dog. But it looks like the dog is very happy to see the cat. It doesn't want to seem to want to chase or bite the cat, which is good. She was just so excited. She was wagging her tail like crazy, wanted to sniff the cat. But the cat's a little skittish, so we only let them be in front of each other for like a minute or two, and then I took the cat back upstairs. So we'll
How do
introduce
you
them
deal with
slowly.
it during the day or?
Well, it's just yesterday. So the first couple of days we're just keeping her in our own bedroom, the cat, and then we'll just keep introducing the two, and then we'll kind of let them go. The fact that Latte is in a cone is probably a good thing for the time being because she can't really get around as quickly. So we'll see how it goes. And then when we're not home, Latte goes in a crate, so there'll be no concerns when we're not home.
So
Cat
you're
can
a
do
cat
whatever.
and dog family just like the Ivies.
Just like the Ivies.
Yeah, one of each.
Yippers. So we're hoping that they become friendly. It's going to take a while for the cat, I think, to acclimate to the dog.
Well, that's with dogs too.
Yeah.
I mean,
I mean, the
it took
problem with
a
our
it
dogs
took a
is
while it
crazy,
took a
though.
while for Scooter and Risa to coexist.
Yeah, and
Scooter
sometimes, I
was
mean.
very tolerable. Like he was tolerable with Risa's bullshit because Risa had to be the alpha, and Scooter was like, "Okay, I'll put up with it. I'll put up with it." But then she would do too much. 'Cause she's a like a herding dog, like a she had healer in her, so she wanted things to be done her way, and she'd get fidgety if they weren't. But they got
Yeah.
into it a couple of times.
Did
One
they
time,
really?
I caused me to pull my arm out of my socket because it was while we were driving.
Oh my God.
I had to reach back there, and they were going at it in the back seat of a Saturn, and I was like trying to separate them, and my arm went out. I was like, ah! And I screamed so loud that they stopped. So
Were
if you
scared.
if you ever if your cat and dog ever get into it, pull your arm out of your socket, and
Yeah,
it'll
that's great.
stop them
That's
immediately.
the trick,
Even when we had the two cats, like we had the one and we got the second one, kind of have, companionship when we're at work and stuff like that. They were fine, and they were like, I mean, they weren't nasty towards each other, but they also really didn't care much about each other. One ended up spending most of their time on at the upstairs, and the other one spent most of the time on the downstairs. And even when they were in the same room together, they weren't anywhere near each other. They really just did their own thing and didn't really care. So it was like, okay, we got the second cat to kind of be friends with the first, but it didn't really work out that way.
I ate my first bowl of cereal with lactaid milk, or whatever it's
Was
called.
it disgusting?
It does it, well. It's not bad. It's not like Bomer drinking cereal with water. That's horrible. But
Yeah,
it's
that's.
not. It doesn't taste as milky. I don't know how to.
Yeah.
But it's not bad, so it's a good substitute.
Is there a reason why you decided to do that?
Yeah, 'cause milk started messing with my stomach. I had to worry about like
Oh.
what milk I was buying. It's
You
not
have
that
no
I get
tolerance for
it's not that
lactose
I it's
anymore?
yeah, I guess not. I'm getting old, man. Shit is just breaking left and right.
That's
Daddy,
not good. Good job.
keepsake. What'd she get?
Another what?
That was Zach. He's got another keychain.
Ah,
Showing me his keychain. It's a Snoopy one.
Oh,
Oh,
Snoopy's
Snoopy. I like
good.
Snoopy.
Hmm?
Snoopy's a good boy.
Yeah.
I like Peppermint Patty because she just calls him Chuck.
Yeah. I like that about her too.
We
She has.
were just watching the Thanksgiving one, and Allie, I think, was a little confused and thought the Peppermint Patty was a boy. So I had to let her know that's a girl, honey.
She's kind of a tomboy.
Yeah, she's very much of a tomboy, and she's got, Marcy as her sidekick, so.
Just out of curiosity, did she ever have like boyfriend, girlfriend, like think of Chuck as a dreamy guy, or was she just a pal
I always took
to
it that
Charlie?
she was interested in Chuck.
Okay.
But I
She
don't
always
know.
had those Birkenstocks too. Like she always had
Yeah.
like she never had shoes. She had the flip-flops all the time.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I feel like in one of the specials, you kind of get a sense that she likes Charlie.
It's been a while since I haven't watched them like in forever. I saw them at Target and I was really tempted to get one, especially like Thanksgiving Charlie Brown and the Christmas, because
Oh yeah.
I remember the Christmas one pretty good because of the
And the
tree.
Halloween one is a classic.
Oh
It's a
yeah,
great
the Great
pumpkin.
Pumpkin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I like when Snoopy makes Thanksgiving dinner and it's like popcorn and
Yep.
you just watched it, Rob. What is he like popcorn candy?
Popcorn can yeah, popcorn. Oh God, what else did they have? A
It's a funny
toast?
dinner though.
Toast.
Toast,
Yeah, toast.
yeah.
Yeah, it was whatever they could just, gather up and make.
And it was just him and Woodstock or what?
Oh,
I guess
they did
so.
have their yeah, they did have their own dinner then afterwards because the kids went to grandma's house. And everyone was invited.
That's what happens when a dog makes Thanksgiving dinner, I guess.
That's right.
So, should we talk about some old comics?
Why don't you kick us off?
All right. Well, I've got three pre-crisis DC stories. Do you want to hear about Aquaman, Superman, or Wonder Woman first?
Let's do
Oh.
Aquaman.
Why? Because it's in alphabetical order?
Yeah, because it's in alphabetical order to appease you. And plus, his movie's coming out, so he's got a movie coming out this month,
Yeah.
like the
I
week
was
before
thinking of doing
Christmas.
that Prime thing a week in advance, but by the time I looked,
Yeah, they were all
there weren't,
sold out.
yeah, there wasn't a lot of
Yeah,
tickets
I
left.
think we're gonna watch it on Saturday.
This Saturday, the Prime
No,
one, the 15th?
the Saturday after it
After?
comes out, yeah.
Gotcha. Okay.
That's when you guys usually go to the movies, right?
We pretty much go to the movies every Yesterday
Well, it's
was an
usually a Saturday
exception. Every
afternoon, isn't it?
Saturday morning, like the
Saturday morning.
10:30 a.m. feature.
And do you have popcorn that early?
Yeah.
Oh.
That's our breakfast actually, is a bucket
Ugh.
of popcorn. No
That's a
butter.
hearty
What do
breakfast.
you have to drink?
It's like Snoopy. Snoopy
Yeah.
had a popcorn.
For
You have to
dinner.
drink then.
Diet Coke.
For instead of like coffee, you've got a Diet Coke.
I don't even know what coffee is. I don't drink coffee. For me, my caffeine in the morning is a diet soda.
Wow.
That's not good for you.
Neither is coffee.
Right, well, the Aquaman story I read was, I guess this is a trade that came out recently. I got everything I read was off of Hoopla. And it looks like they put this trade out recently. It's Aquaman: The Search for Mira.
Oh,
Is
I
it?
just got that. Yeah.
Oh,
Did
is it a
you?
hardcover, Rob?
Yeah.
I think
Oh
so, yeah. It's like
yeah, it
a
has the
deluxe
Skeets cover,
edition.
right? Or the Aparo, where
Yeah, it's
Aquaman's on the he's drowning
on the
on the
shore or
beach.
whatever.
Yeah,
Yeah. Yeah.
yeah. I just got that too.
Yeah,
Well,
looked good.
I only read the first story, so I won't ruin too much of it for
That's
you.
okay. Go for it. Yeah.
It's got a nice Nick Carty cover. Nick Carty
But
was a
what is the Aquaman issue that it's covering?
It's number 40.
Okay.
And it's got a Nick Carty cover. Nick Carty had been the penciler in Aquaman prior to this, I believe. With it's got Mira's face kind of as if she's sort of a vision in the water, and her hair is flowing out, and Aquaman and Aqualad are caught up in her hair. But the art itself and the issues by Jim Aparo and the story, as you said, was Steve Skeets. And it starts out Mira's with Aquaman, Aqualad, and Aquababy. When this sort of whirlwind or force of sudden water starts hits them and separates them and starts throwing sand up from the ocean floor, and Aquaman loses sight of everybody else. When he kind of comes out of this area of water that he can't see through, he sees some shadows in the distance, and it looks like several figures are dragging Mira away. And then he gets, before he can get a good look at who's throwing the punch, he gets hit in the face and knocked out. So back in Atlantis, Tula, Aqua Girl, she's suspicious that something's wrong because none of the others have shown up for the council meeting that's going on. So she heads out to look for them, and she finds Aqualad and Aquababy and Aquaman as he's recovering from the punch that he took. And so they try to figure out what's going on. They go back to Atlantis so that Aquaman can recover a little bit. Soon he and Aqualad are off to try to search for Mira. And after searching for a day or so, they come across what this is all still underwater. They're, you know, riding their seahorses. They come across what looks like a medieval village underwater, but it's like shimmering in the distance as if it was some sort of mirage. So they get closer, and you know, there's gates. It's a walled city. They end up deciding to get some robes as a disguise to go into the city and sort of figure out what's going on. The end of part one is when they spy this sort of congregation going through the city with a woman that looks just like Mira leading the procession. And people are treating her like they're, and bowing down to her and stuff as if she's their queen. So part two starts when a man comes upon the two of them and discovers them and realizes that they're not, that they're outsiders, that they don't belong in the city because they're not bowing in the same way that everyone else is, as this woman that looks like Mira is passing. So Aquaman tries to just take off from the guy to find Mira and rescue her, but a whole bunch of robed men start attacking him, and he's not really having a problem with them physically, but there's a lot of them. It's a distraction. One guy comes after him with a sword, and he and Aqualad get separated, and Aqualad ends up getting overwhelmed by a bunch of them himself. Eventually, the two of them are okay, but Aqualad's hurt his arm. So they're trying to figure out what's going on. They're caught in this this room, someone starts to pump the water out of this room. So, you know, at this time, both of them can only spend an hour or so out of water. Mm-hmm. So that's like a dangerous situation for them. You know, one of the things that Aquaman has gotten teased about in the fat past is his ability to talk to animals, but they make a cool use of it here. And Jim Aparo does a nice job on a kind of, it's like a split double page splash. It's got like two thirds of the double page splash. The top two thirds show the giant bull whale that Aquaman called in swooping down and smashing into the wall of the room that they're in to set them free. It's really nice. Kind of planning they did, sort of turn that, you turn the page and see that, makes a nice effect. But at this point, Aqualad's passed out from his injuries, so Aquaman has to attend to him and carry him, gets him on a seahorse, and has to lead both the seahorse that he's on and Aqualad's seahorse, and take him back to Atlantis and give him over to be treated. So Aquaman then heads back out, but at this point he's been gone for like 3 days straight, and so he settles down for a nap, only to wake up later to this monstrous purple sea creature that attacks him, that ends up being an illusion, some kind of sorcery that's meant to scare him away from returning to this medieval city. So he goes back there and finds what he thinks is the queen's room. But there's a man standing outside that seems to be a wizard sort of guy who blasts him with this this energy ray kind of thing. And Aquaman slowly struggles his way through the power of this ray, eventually manages to punch the guy and knock him out. And so he's able to get into the queen's room, and she acts as if she doesn't know him at all and is frightened by this man barging into her room and what does he want and everything. And Aquaman's asking why she doesn't recognize him, and eventually he gets close enough to her to look into her face and realizes that the woman has different colored eyes than Mira. And so basically, I don't know if any more comes of this later on in the story, but essentially she turns out to be a lookalike, someone that could be Mira's twin, basically, if it wasn't for the different eye color. And so Aquaman concludes that it was all a big coincidence. He heads out to figure out, or just to continue his search for Mira. So, like I said, I don't know, maybe like some of this is brought back later on, and because this collection goes, I think, to issue 48. So I don't know if any of this plays into things later on. But so it was a little bit of a let down as far as an ending to the story. But the Jim Aparo art was really nice. And obviously Mira is still missing, so there's that to continue the thread. But it was interesting to read, just because I haven't read really any older Aquaman from this era. So it's definitely cool that they obviously expect some collections to come out because of the movie. It's cool that they chose to put out some of this older stuff that I've heard about but never gotten a chance to see.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is that until past couple of years where I picked up a couple other issues, the only issue that I owned from that first run of Aquaman for like 20 years was that issue. I was just looking at my database. I'm like, That's funny. Like literally the only one I have until like a couple of years ago. I managed, like got like 51 and 52 or something. But yeah, I'm like, for all the ones that just you happen to, you know, that is in there and that you happen to cover, is the one that I actually have owned since I was a kid, and that was the only one.
Yeah, no,
I don't remember anything about it though.
Yeah, hopefully it'll be just as easy to sneak back into your house to put it back in your collection as it was to get it out of there. But
we'll both be at work tomorrow until at least 4:30.
Hopefully this episode will come out after that.
Yeah, I hope so too. I was thinking that after I said it.
Mike, are you still there?
I think Mike falls.
Yeah, I'm here. When you get to the tail end of the series, it's where it really starts to kick in. In my opinion, when Michelini starts over. When he takes over, when they relaunch it, like you go from the 12-cent issues into the 35-cent issues, and that's when I really started to like it.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
When he loses his son.
When that's like in the 70s, then 1970s.
The Michelini, yes, late 70s, 77. Yeah, so it jumped from 71 to 77.
Gotcha. You want me to go next?
Sure.
Sure.
Okay. So today I'm just going to give a general overview of four issues. It was a story arc, and I've been reading Sandman Mystery Theater, the Deluxe Volume 2. So this is issues number 17 through 20. The arc is called The Scorpion. Have either one of you read any Sandman Mystery Theater?
Yeah, I've read them all.
Yeah. Chris, have you read any or no?
Wesley.
No, I've wanted to, but I haven't read any.
It's really cool in that, just in general.
It's very pulpy. You know,
Chris, I think that you would like it as well. And it is cool that there's so much, because of this series, there's so much that you could read, you know, from the Golden Age Sandman, that you don't get a lot of long series based on a very old superhero, you know, that delves in deep like this. And I really appreciate that this one, you know, like 70 issues back in the day. You guys, I didn't collect this series at all, and I started hearing great things about it. I ended up buying the entire run on eBay at one point years ago, and that's how I ended up getting the complete series all at once. But then when they had the collections started, they only did, unfortunately, it looks like they've only done one and two. I haven't seen a solicitation for probably a good year now, so I'm assuming they didn't really sell. But so anyhow, in this particular story arc, what you've got is some, you know, this is just before World War II. It's still in the height of the Depression. Wesley Dodds is, you know, very wealthy from his late father's money. There is a group of people that are trying to raise money for an oil venture in Texas, and And another, oh, actually, and actually expanding into Europe too. That's where they think the extra money will come from, because they figure if they get in there early, they can actually jack up prices once, because they know that the United States is eventually going to have to get into World War II. So they're trying to get ahead of the game. And they had a fundraiser, and they're trying to get Wesley Dodds to contribute and become a partner. And he doesn't really, he's basically, what's going on at the beginning of this arc is he's kind of noticing the huge difference between the haves and the have-nots during the Depression, and how it's kind of obscene in his eyes that people are spending, you know, whatever amount of money per plate at this fundraiser, while people are like boiling shoe leather to survive. And so he doesn't really want anything to do with this. But also what's happening at the same time is there's four or five other partners for this venture. And the first one ends up being killed. And of course we see what's happening, but the police and the Sandman aren't there. But we see that there's a masked guy, almost dressed in Western style, that all he has to do is whip a person once on the skin, and there's a very toxic scorpion venom on his whip, and if it breaks the skin, the person dies within five minutes or so. And so he kills one of the partners, and this is how it comes to Wesley's attention to try to see what's going on. So after initially saying that he doesn't want to be a partner in this, and then a second partner dies, he ends up pretending that he's interested so he can get some extra information. And so he does that, and sure enough, this guy called the Scorpion comes after him, and he actually defeats the Sandman and whips and actually breaks the skin on his hand, I believe. But luckily, from if you followed this at all, you know that Wesley Dodds did a lot of research and learning in the East too, and he has a lot of between meditation techniques, and he has a lot of antidotes for things he manages to get to his dresser, where he has lots of different, like a whole display of antidotes inside a compartment, and he manages to inject himself with an antidote before he dies. So although he's weak, he's still alive. In the meantime, I think another big part of this series was his relationship to Diane Belmont, who becomes his wife, historically speaking. And in this,
I really like their relationship in this series.
Isn't it?
She's like helps him. Like,
yeah, yeah.
So she's amazing in the series, like a really strong woman character.
Fantastic. And during the 30s. And Mike, just like you said, she, because her dad is the district attorney, she overhears a lot of what's going on in the city, and she is kind of like an amateur sleuth herself, where she likes to try to figure these things out. So she's trying to investigate. What I was going to say with their relationship is, at the beginning of this arc, it's only into, I think it was the arc before, that they even kind of decided that they wanted to go together. So she does not know that he's the Sandman yet. And, you know, he's awkwardly excusing himself at different stages, and very confusing for her, because he's very passionate and very obviously interested in her. And then, you know, like 10 minutes later, suddenly he's saying, "Oh, I forgot a meeting," and rushing off. So it's very confusing to her, but she's finding him very interesting, and the feeling's mutual. So by the end of this, you find that the killer is actually one of a junior partner to the main person in charge of this venture. And this guy is from Texas, and what you learn is that they took over his dad. They bought out his father's farm for oil. And although you don't know what the truth is, but it really does seem from the dialogue and how irrational the Texan, the Scorpion is that they gave his dad a very, like, very fair price, like a good price for the land. They didn't try to, you know, steal it out from under him. But it sounds like his dad really didn't know what to do with the money, and he ended up gambling it all away and becoming destitute, and then ended up just dying a drunk. So so the son, this junior partner, ended up going to school and involving himself in this in order to get revenge to these people who he thinks basically, you know, indirectly killed his dad. But of course, the Sandman and with Diane's help end up catching him and putting him away. And by the end of this arc, you get the strong feeling that although Diane doesn't know that he's the Sandman, she's starting to get a very good idea that this is a good possibility. So I'll be reading the next arc, you know, in the next few days, and I'll see if that actually starts moving forward. I haven't read this series since I originally bought it on eBay years ago. So this has been fun to kind of revisit, even though it's only going to go to issue 24, and then I'll probably move on to other things, and I probably won't go back to the single issues to reread the rest of the run. But you never
read it before?
I had read the whole run after
when you bought it on eBay. Okay, I gotcha.
Yeah, but I haven't reread it since. So
yeah, DC and their trades, really, man, they've been soliciting a crap load of stuff that they've been canceling left and right.
What are they doing? I don't. And then did you see the other history of the DC Universe?
Yeah.
It just got, I mean, that might get resolicited, I guess, but like a lot, but like the trades themselves, yeah, a lot of stuff are, I don't know what's going on.
Well, the Sandman one, they were supposed to finish and they failed it. Was it the Nightwing one that, no, there was another one. It was the Kyle Rayner one they canceled.
Mm-hmm.
They were retrading all of Kyle's tales, and they got through two of them, I believe, and then the third one was discontinued. This one was discontinued after three or two?
Two, just two. This
yeah,
is just it.
Two. But they solicited the third one, and then they canceled it.
Oh,
and then,
did they?
And
I
then
didn't
one,
even notice
one of
that.
The big ones was the Detective Comics pre-Batman Detective two-volume set.
That was going to be a beautiful hardcover
set. Oh my God.
That I was going to put on my shelf right before the Batman one.
And then they did the Monsters of Evil from Shazam. They canceled that. I mean, they've been canceling books left and right.
I mean, I understand, I guess, in general, if you're not getting the sales numbers, you can't keep continuing republishing a run. But obviously the Shazam one, that wasn't what the issue was. And I wonder if the early Detective Comics 1 through 26, if it was I never heard any reason why they did it. I wonder if it was a similar concern in that
there's a lot of
offensive material in there.
I think the people that would be getting it, that would actually buy that would drop like $100 on this kind of hardcover, mm-hmm. know historically that blacks weren't treated well, or for that matter, anybody. that wasn't white.
yeah, wasn't a white man.
Or people from another country, you know.
Right. Oh yeah.
So
yeah. There's, you know, Asian or whatever.
They are going to be portrayed very bad.
Yeah.
Like even the Spirit with Ebony White. I mean, that's notoriously awful the way that's treated. But they reprinted that. So I think they should reprint this other material. I mean, it's good to be aware of the time that this was published, and it's good to be aware of historically what was being presented.
Yeah.
And I think you can't always hide behind what we were or what we are.
and that's the thing is that obviously, you know, that you – I guess I understand. I mean, it's very easy for me to say that – because it's not me that's being portrayed in a, do you know what I mean? So it's easy for me to say, oh, you know, this is, but like to your point, I think, you know, it's, I don't know.
It's
I
historically
want to see that historical count.
relevant. It's historically relevant
Yeah, I mean, I
because
personally want to
that's
see
how it
that.
was. And
But
whether or
you know, on
not
the other on the other
it
hand
shouldn't
is, you
make
know.
you feel that you have to treat people that way. I mean
No.
it should open your eyes is what it should do.
But the problem is there's a lot of stupid people out there too.
That
That
is true.
you know, and the and I mean, I think that
There's
like
that
you said.
song, everybody knows that the world is full of stupid people.
That's
I forget
right.
who sings that, but it's like,
The
oh, the
refreshments?
Refreshments.
Is that right? Banditos?
Yeah, the Bandidos. That is a good CD, by the
That's a
way.
great
I'm
CD.
glad you remembered it because
Yeah.
that song is the only one that like sticks out for me, but like I'll
Yeah.
remember the lyrics, but I like it a lot. But
I have
meet
that
me
song
at the mission
on
at
my shuffle.
midnight. Yeah, I know I like that
But
song.
yeah,
That was a 90s song, wasn't it? In the 90s?
90s, yeah. Oh yeah, that was like during the height of like 90s quote unquote alternative music where all these bands had like, you know, at least one big hit in that, you know, genre, and I think that was the Refreshments' biggest, you know, the one that was everyone knew.
Yeah.
But
All right.
yeah, I mean, I take your point. I would love to see them. I mean, I would love to see
They're books that
Detective
we'll never
126.
be
I've
able to
never
read
seen anything.
unless, yeah, they're books that we'll never ever be able to read in single issues and read legally. Well,
Yeah.
some of it's probably gone to, what do you call it, open
Sir, whatever.
public domain. Because I know like if I really wanted to go read all the Freedom Fighters stuff, it's in public domain, like on that site. So I could go read Uncle Sam and The Human Bomb and Phantom Lady. But I've been able to find some of them. There's like a collected comics library something or another. Not the podcast, but they actually reproduce books, and you'll be able to find stuff on Amazon. And they're in paperback. And they've been
Oh.
doing like a lot of the quality stuff, so I've been getting a lot of the Black Hawk books. And they're not the best reproduction of like what DC would do with them, but they're good enough to read and enjoy. So that's
Let
one
me ask you
alternative.
a quick question. This kind of because you reminded me with quality. Do you have that? I think it's a Tomorrow book, that Quality Companion.
Yeah, I love that.
Is
That's
it good?
amazing.
So I saw it being
Absolutely.
resolicited again, so I was thinking of buying it.
Yeah.
You
Oh,
recommend it?
it is the best one, at least in my opinion, but I'm biased because I
Well,
love.
I'm interested in those in learning about
It is
those
well put together
era,
because it's
so.
like it puts together a history of all their books, and then it like has like a breakdown of all their characters and then has like really good interviews and stuff. It's really well done.
All right, good. Because I
I
mean,
highly recommend
I
them.
already put it on my order, but if you would have told me that it was no good, then I would have taken
Yeah,
it off.
that's my favorite. And that's my favorite above like the Bat Cave one and the Blue Beetle companion and
Wow.
the Hawkman had a Hawkman companion. I have all of those, but my favorite is the Quality Companion. I don't have the JSA or the ones that they did for the JSA. I'd really like to have them. But the first
I've
one's
got
out of
the
print.
Archie Heroes one, and now
Yeah.
I'll have this one.
Yeah, I have the Archie Heroes one too. They're really good like reference material. Like if you ever just want to pull something off the shelf and look up a character, it's really good stuff.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'm gonna take you back to Crisis Times,
All right.
1987. Wasn't that around Crisis?
Yes, it was.
Well, around 1987, DC decided to launch a book. That was in the Vertigo realm before Vertigo even existed. And the book is called Wasteland. And what I
Oh.
remember very fondly of this book is it was one of the first books that I when me and Barb were dating in high school, that I gave her to look at. And she actually read this series. So it's an anthology that has like three stories, and it features John Ostrander and a guy called Del Close. Del Close is, he's even admitted, he's sort of the Grant Morrison of 1987, where he was doing a lot of drugs. And what he tells in stories are sometimes drug-induced. But this was one issue. Sometimes I go into my database, and Rob probably does the same, and you're just like scanning through titles in your collection, and you say, oh, crap, I'm missing one issue of something. So I was missing issue 16 of Wasteland, and I put it in my last mycomicshop.com order, and I read it for this issue. Interesting enough, it has a holiday story in it, so it's appropriate. It's a real dark tale, but and then it has one story called The Woman Who Tried to Find God, and it's very depressing. And if you're real religious or not religious, this story sort of pertains, because it asks the question of, if there is a God, how can this happen? How can this be? And this story was told by John Ostrander based on a adaptation from a Balian African folktale. And it's about a woman named Nemba. And she has a long lineage, and it shows how her life is pretty much led in death. In other words, she sees all her siblings die, and she's one of the only survivors, basically of starvation in Africa and stuff like that, and just conditions. She sees her friends die. She sees her husband die. Even all of her own children die. And then she says, well, she has one grandchildren, and she thinks she can keep that child alive, and that grandchild dies. And then she sets on a mission. She's like, everyone I've ever loved or ever been with has died, and I need to go question God. So she goes on this journey. She builds this like huge tower of lumber all the way to the sky, thinking she can reach the sky, but the wood at the bottom rots away and she falls. She tries to rebuild it and it falls. And she's like, well, how can I get to the sky and reach this? She goes on a journey across the world to try to find God. And she gets into like the United States, and she finds the tallest tower, which is called the Trimpy Tower. Interesting enough. But it's the world's tallest building. She gets into that tower, goes to the very top, and she meets a black construction worker. And the guy tells her, what the hell are you doing up here, old woman? And he says, I'm seeking Lisa, the god. And he says, Lisa, why would you do that? And she says, how can you look at me and ask that? Where is there anyone who has suffered as I? And the construction worker says, yeah, how are you hurting? She said, I'm alone. All my friends, all my family have all been taken from me. And the construction worker says, so what? How's that make you any different from anybody else? Same damn thing happens to all of us. So she pretty much listens to this, goes back down, and dies. It's pretty damn depressing. So her journey to God is like meeting somebody that saying, hey, this is life.
Yeah.
You're going to lose everything that you've ever loved. And it's pretty damn depressing. And the next story is called All I Want for Christmas is the Head of Idi Amin. And if you knew this guy, he was a politician and military dictator, and also the president of Uganda from 1971 to 1979.
He was a real sweetheart.
He was known for his human rights abuses, political repression, ethnic persecution, killings, nepotism, corruption, and gross economic mismanagement. Not a good person.
Oh.
So the story is told as this place happens in a mall, and every year, every 10 years or so, the real Santa will come to work at a mall instead of having a fake Santa. And he gets there, and all these kids are saying what gifts they want, and he's like going to make these gifts happen. And one little kid gets on his lap and he says, "I want the head of this Idi Amin." And he's like, "What? Are you serious? You want the head of this dictator?" And he says, "Why?" And the kid says, "Since when does Santa need a reason? Does a bicycle need a reason?" And he's like, "Huh." So Santa like can actually get into his time machine and goes back when he's a dictatorship and brings him the head of. And it's interesting because the dictator says, I celebrate Christmas too." And then he gets a second thought, maybe I shouldn't take this guy's head off. But he turns his back, and Amin comes at him with a musket and is going to stab him in the back, and Santa takes his head off and then brings it to the kid, and the kid's happy as hell. But he realizes that kid is his father works for the CIA and he essentially brought the head of this dictator.
God.
The third story is a John Ostrander written story, probably the most depressing, called Heart Shadow. It's about a woman, and she's got a gun, and every morning she thinks about blowing her brains out. And she meets this one woman, or this teenager, and she like looks at her, and she says, take it her, for instance, the girl's very sure of herself, doesn't listen to anyone else, has the world beat. She doesn't know it, but she's pregnant by her boyfriend. He'll jackrabbit, and her folks don't believe in abortion. She'll have the kid, and her life is over, and she doesn't even know it. But I know it. And she's thinking of killing the kid and putting out her misery, but how does she even know this? She then goes to her job, and then you have a flashback of her going out at night, meeting a man, and then him tying her up to the bed and abusing her because she wants to be abused. But it gives a flashback to when the girl is a very little girl and she has a father do the same thing to her as a little girl and abuser. And it ends really dark and depressing. She finds a character that's like Michael Jackson and she wants to be with him because the one thing in life that makes her happy is Michael Jackson. But that didn't turn out well. So she goes back home, picks up the gun, and blows her brains out. So this is the type of stories that you get in Wasteland. It's really dark. And it was Vertigo before Vertigo even existed. But it was
I have
very
the first
different.
7 issues of this run, yeah. But I ended up not... I stopped it. I think it was just a little too much for me at the time.
Yeah. It's not for everyone. But if you like anthologies of really dark and twisted and stories and Vertigo-esque tales, it's, you probably like it.
Yeah.
So, Chris, you're up.
Cool. All right. So, Superman or Wonder Woman?
What's Wonder next? Woman.
Oh. Was that hard for you to say, Rob?
No. I wanted to fool everyone.
Break out of the alphabet.
That's right.
All right. So this is the first story in the Wonder Woman, the 12 Labors trade.
Oh.
And this is a storyline that I believe comes just after the Diana Prince time period, where she was the martial arts, didn't have her superpowers. That
Do
whole
you know
thing.
What issue that is or no?
It is 212.
Thanks. Just going to look it up.
Yeah. So it has Wonder Woman on the cover with Batman, Superman, Flash, and Green Lantern. Superman saying, "Please, Wonder Woman, you must come back. The Justice League needs you." And she says, "No, Superman, I can't." And so this is written by Len Wein with art by Kurt Swan and Tex Blaisdell. And it's framed as a story that Superman is telling to Batman, Flash, and Green Lantern in Justice League headquarters in the satellite. And it starts out with Clark Kent reporting outside the United Nations, where the prime minister of a country named Pamanasian, from her name is Indira Gamal, so I think it's supposed to be like a fictional Southeast Asian country like India or Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
So she's supposed to be addressing the United Nations when some gunmen parachute into the scene to try to assassinate her. And Clark's on camera, so he's trying to figure out what he could do when Wonder Woman rushes onto the scene and starts deflecting the bullets fired at her with her bracelets and takes out the gunmen. Well, the gunmen actually turn out to be gun women. A man named Morgan Tracy, who Superman describes as the UN's troubleshooter diplomat, tackles one of the gunmen himself and pulls off her mask. It turns out to be a blonde, attractive woman. This was kind of surprising, of course. And later, after Ms. Gamal had made her speech to the UN, the camera crew from Clark's, from I don't know if it's Galaxy News at this point or whatever, but the camera crew is still on scene to film the arrest of the woman, gunwoman, and one of the women gets a hold of one of the police officer's guns, and Diana Prince comes running in and karate chops the woman in the neck, Morgan Tracy, the man that was on the scene earlier, he offers Diana a job working at the UN's crisis bureau as his associate. So she lets him know that he'll think about it. And so then Diana and Clark get a moment to the side. They're able to talk privately, and Clark asks her when her superpowers returned, and she says, "What are you talking about? I've never lost them." And Clark says, "Well, of course you did. That's why you resigned from the Justice League." She says, "Resigned? Well, that explains why I haven't been called for meetings." It's like, Clark, I don't remember resigning from the JLA. I don't even remember losing my powers. So Clark says, "There's definitely something wrong. We better head to the headquarters. I'll meet you there as soon as I can slip away." So she becomes Wonder Woman and takes off in her invisible plane. And then later at the satellite, Superman arrives, and only to be told by the Flash that Wonder Woman hasn't shown up. Well, Superman realizes what's happened and takes off and heads to the site of the Justice League's old Mountain Sanctuary headquarters, and where he explains that to Wonder Woman that they haven't met there in months. And again, Wonder Woman's confused as to why she doesn't remember, doesn't know that they have the satellite headquarters now. So Superman leads her to the new headquarters, and they sit down with Batman and Hal Jordan and Barry Allen, and you know, they Batman says, you know, well, we can't find anything wrong with your memory except for the fact that you can't remember those months that you spent without your powers. And she said, well, she said, I can't just, you know, basically can't just deal with losing that much of my past. I want to know what happened to I Ching, who was my mentor, and I want to know what happened to Steve Trevor. I have a lot of questions. Superman says, well, you know, calm down, we'll help you. And Wonder Woman tells him, well, I'd really like to join the Justice League again, but until my memory returns and the state that I'm in, I don't feel like I belong. And they tell her, you know, that's absurd. We need you in the group. And she's afraid that her memory will fail her some other time. Or so basically they come up with this idea that based on the 12 labors of Hercules, that Wonder Woman says, you know, I want the Justice League to monitor my next 12 adventures. And if I succeed in those tasks without incident, then I'll join back to the Justice League. So they decide, okay, well, that's what we'll do. And in the meantime, Wonder Woman heads off to back to Paradise Island. And she confronts Hippolyta. She says, I want to know why my own mother would betray me. And Hippolyta doesn't know what she's talking about. Well, Wonder Woman says, we both know that Amazon technology is capable of producing selective amnesia. So she thinks that her mom is to blame for what happened. And Hippolyta explains that Diana's memory was completely gone. And they have something called the Amazon memory chair, which is kind of funny. But she said, we did the best we could, but we couldn't restore your memories of when you had no powers because our records were incomplete from that period. And she said, we didn't want to give you just half memories. And Diana is upset that they made this decision on her behalf to, you know, not even give her those partial memories of that time period. And she says, you know, I want to know what happened to Steve Trevor. And Hippolyta tells her, Steve Trevor's dead. The Steve that you've been with these past weeks was a mentally induced substitute designed to maintain your psychological stability. So I don't know what's all together with that. But Diana leaves Paradise Island pretty upset and heads back to her apartment in New York. And just this whole kind of situation is catching up with her. But she thinks, you know, maybe I should take that job that I was offered at the Crisis Bureau. At least that will be busy enough to be a distraction. So she tries to call Morgan Tracy, but a different man answers and tells her to go to this, that he's not home, but if you really need to talk to him, or he's not, you know, he's not in his office, but if you really need to talk to him, go to this nightclub called the Casbah. Diana thinks, well, I've got to do this, but I'm kind of surprised that he's at this swank nightclub. So we switch to the nightclub where Tracy is entertaining the woman that spoke earlier at the UN, Prime Minister Gamal. When a man walks up to them, tells him that he's the owner of the Casbah, and he's honored that she had come to visit their establishment and check if everything was okay. And she said, yeah, it's been great. And all of a sudden, the floor opens up underneath their seats, and both of them go falling in through this kind of trapdoor thing. So shortly after this happens, Diana shows up outside the Casbah, and she suddenly has this feeling that something's wrong. So instead of going in, she changes to Wonder Woman, and then we see underneath the guy that's the owner of the Casbah appears before Tracy, the guy from the UN, as the Cavalier in his changed clothing. And I'm kind of surprised that I'm impressed that Tracy doesn't just like start cracking up, but he's dressed as like one of the Three Musketeers. Basically,
the Cavalier, the Batman villain.
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm not really familiar with the Batman villain.
He's flamboyant looking, like a musketeer.
Yeah. Might be able to research and show, see if this same character that shows as an appearance in this issue, but he's got like basically the women that did attacked the guns earlier in the issue were his women that he has under his hypnotic spell, and now they're dressed in like white diaphanous pants and like yellow fringed bras, like Bond women or something. So his plot is something like that he's going to blame the U.S. For assassinating Kamal, and he's going to take control of her country or something along those lines. But essentially, he's about to have the women that he's controlling shoot Tracy when Wonder Woman comes busting through the wall and takes out the women. But she's particularly mad at the Cavalier for causing her to have to attack other women. When he starts to try to use his powers on her of seduction, like his hypnotic powers. And all the while this is going on, Superman with his X-ray vision is watching from above, like monitoring her mission. And it seems like Wonder Woman's going to fall under her spell, but she's able to break past it with her will and basically smacks him across the face and knocks him flat. That's the first time, Cavalier remarks, is the first time anyone's ever, any woman has been able to overcome his chemically induced powers. So they battle it out a little bit more, Wonder Woman takes apart his sword with her lasso, and his hat fires razor-pointed plumes that she knocks out of the air with her tiara. And as a last-ditch effort, he tries to pull out a snuff box. Before he can do anything with it, she just blows it back in his face, and something about it breaks the spell that the other women that he's had under control, and they run at him and attack him. And then Wonder Woman lassos all of them together and commands them to fall asleep, and sets Morgan Tracy free. Then it goes back to the four Justice League members talking in the satellite, and Superman surmising or basically summarizing that Wonder Woman passed the test. Batman says, "Well, I do. I agree with you. I find it kind of hard to swallow that part that you said that Wonder Woman's intuition warned her that there was a problem inside the Casbah, and Superman admits that, well, okay, everything was what, as I said, it was, except for that whole bit about her intuition was actually a bit of subliminal superventriloquism on my part. and then he chooses the Flash as the next member to monitor Wonder Woman's adventure. So, and that's what it seems happens in the next issue. So, yeah, each issue of the storyline has a different Justice League member. I actually own issue 216, which looks, I haven't read it, but looks like that Black Canary's turn in that issue. But
did you read this?
It was kind of fun.
You read this one in print?
No, this one I read. All the other ones I read were digital through the Hoopla.
What was that Hoopla collected in? What was that it collected in?
It's a trade called The 12 Labors. Huh. Wonder Woman, the 12 Labors.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I wasn't aware of that one collected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was looking for it. I didn't see it in the database. That's why I asked for the number.
Yeah, I don't know if I searched for it on Amazon and it comes up as you can get it digitally, but then the other ones are just available by other sellers and like inflated prices. It's shown a publication date of July 2012. So I don't know. And it has the Peel logo. The DC logo is the Peel one.
Oh yeah, so I mean that's not that.
So that would be 2012. It's around the time.
Yeah, for sure.
They were using that New 52. So
interesting.
Well, it's listed as book 12. No, that can't be it. It's listed as book
3. Here it is. Book yeah, you 3. See it down at the bottom. Yeah.
Yep.
Collects 212 to 222. Chris,
I don't like when they do that. Yeah. When the database does this, because book 1 is collecting 600 through 606. Book 2 is 607, and then you go backwards. I'd rather that have it be in the database as Wonder Woman, the 12 labors of, you know, the exactly. 12 labors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Interesting.
It's cool. You've been reading some good old stuff, Chris.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
Uh huh.
Mm-hmm.
What's your next pick, right. Rob? Did you watch Christmas Vacation to get us in the Christmas mood?
No, I watched a scary movie to get us in the Christmas mood.
No, you want to watch Christmas Vacation? Damn it!
I keep forgetting about it. Stacy would be up for it. She's seen it before.
Does she like it?
She liked it. I think so.
Well, then what's wrong with you, man?
No one can answer that question.
I want to know how you feel about it, where it ranks in Christmas movies after you watch it.
Well, don't you feel like you guys are hyping it up way too much, and I'm only going to be disappointed
I think,
now?
I think it lives up to the hype. I think you do. It does. Yeah. I watch it every year.
You do?
Yeah.
Every year, every Christmas?
Every year, every Christmas. That's my Christmas story movie.
Are you going to watch It's a Wonderful Life this year?
Probably not.
Well, if you do, then I'll watch Christmas Vacation. And then we can cover
the gauntlet is dropped.
Yeah, and then we can cover those movies.
Oh, man, the gauntlet. I got to find A Wonderful Life now.
Yeah, it's a good one. Can probably get it on, I don't know.
It's no Christmas Vacation, that's for sure.
No, it's much better than that.
Mm-mm.
It's so apples and oranges, to be honest with you.
What's your next...
Okay, so I'm going to talk today. I'm going to I wanted to tell you about a movie that it took me a couple days to watch, and not because it wasn't good, but because I can't keep my eyes open in the evening for some reason. I watched Alice, Sweet Alice. Have you guys seen this movie?
No, it doesn't ring a bell. I think I've heard of it, but
okay. So it definitely it's not that, you know, I finally finished it this morning because I kept falling asleep, but it's not because it was bad. I was just, I don't know, I just couldn't keep my eyes open. Okay, so very early on, at the beginning of this movie, there's a mother that has two daughters, two younger daughters, about 12 years old, and well, I don't think they're twins, so one's a little bit older than the other. I think the older one's 12. And father is divorced. And they're going for the younger girl's first communion. And she is played, her name's Karen, and she's played by Brooke Shields. So I think she was about 8 years old or something like that. And Mike, It's a Wonderful Life is free on Prime.
Okay.
And so
I get the gauntlet. I have to do it, but you better do your part. I don't want to do it and then have you fail me.
No, well, first of all, you'll thank me, but I will definitely watch it.
I will be a Scrooge, though. I'll be pissed if I do my part, even if
no,
I like it.
No, I just told you I'm going to watch it. Looks like I'm going to have to pay to watch it, but I'll watch it. $3.99.
There you go. I'll pay you your $3.99.
Spend a dollar more, you could probably find it, the DVD, for like $5.
Probably, right? Okay, so back to Alice, Sweet Alice. So Brooke Shields, Karen is getting her first communion. It happens very early on, but I mean, you immediately get the feeling that
is this
her older
Brooke Shields prior to Blue Lagoon, or is this?
Yeah, she's only eight. This is like 1976 or something like
this
that.
Is prior to Blue Lagoon.
Yeah, so you get the idea immediately through the interactions with her mom as well as her aunt and uncle that Alice is the older girl and she is very much ignored and even just not talked to even all that nicely. And Karen, the Brooke Shields character, seems to be like the cute golden child who like can do no wrong. And very apparent, like right away. And so that anyhow, they go to their first communion and you see that somebody like kind of Karen's going to be the last one out from the back into the actual service. And you see that somebody actually grabs her and kills her and stuffs her body in this like a long box or whatever and actually sets it on fire. So the person is wearing like a yellow, it's a small person wearing a yellow raincoat with like a creepy, like almost transparent mask. It has like the like lipstick and like eye color and or what do you call it?
Mascara?
Yeah, eyeshadow. Thank you.
Yeah, I've seen
if you look it up, you can see what the killer looks like. It's
In like horror documentaries or retrospectives or something like that, I've seen stills of the mask and yellow raincoat. It's pretty creepy looking.
It's very creepy. Yeah. So you're definitely led to believe because like shortly after that, Alice bends down and picks up her sister's veil. So you're definitely given the impression immediately that Alice is the killer. And so then now they're trying to figure out. The police are interviewing everyone. There's a policeman involved. The father was there, of course, for the communion itself. So he's trying to investigate who the killer is, and none of the family would want to believe that that Alice had anything to do with it. You see, they live in an apartment building, and you see that Alice goes down to the basement of the apartment building. She has like she's got like a collection in a glass jar of like cockroaches. She has like all this weird, just odd stuff. She's a very odd girl. And then a little bit down the road, she gets in a big argument with her aunt. She takes off. The aunt leaves a little while later, and as the aunt's walking down the stairs, somebody reaches from like the lower part of the stairwell and starts stabbing the aunt and getting her in the leg and even in the foot and stuff like that. And then the person, again, it's, you can't see who it is, but you see the same outfit with the raincoat and the mask. And then they run away before anyone can get up to them. So again, it's assumed that this is Alice, and indeed the aunt actually comes right out and tells the police that that's who it was. And the mother still does not want to believe this. Farther into the movie, you have the father who's actually sees, we're assuming Alice, all still dressed up in the mask and the raincoat, running around, just going around town, and she's kind of following her from afar, and ends up catching her in an abandoned building. And should I give spoilers, or should I not give spoilers to this?
It's an old movie. I think you could give spoilers.
All right. I mean, I'm just, yeah, I wanted to know what you guys thought. Chris, you're okay with that?
Or, yeah, whatever you want to do.
Okay. So he starts looking around in this abandoned building, and you see the person behind like a pillar, and when he comes around, the person knocks him in the head with a piece of a brick and keeps beating him over the head, and he comes to all tied up, and they're basically rolling him out through this like large like service store, but it's three stories up, almost like a crane would come over and like put things into the third floor directly through, like with a crane. So it's a very large open door, three stories up, and keeps rolling him. He manages to get a little bit loose and grabs the mask and takes it off, and it's not Alice. It's actually this priest's Father Tom's, I guess, I don't know what you would call her, but she like kind of cares for the rectory and like, you know, makes him his lunch and like cares for the house and stuff like that where the priests live. There's an old Monsignor and this priest, and she's very short. So it turns out that it's her. She manages to push him off the third floor, and he lands on a bunch of rocks and stuff and he dies. So what you find out later on when she's confronting the mother, but they don't know that she's the killer yet, is that she's been a very devoted Catholic all her life, and you know, obviously she's taking care of these priests, and she just when her daughter was about to have her first communion, her daughter died somehow, and it's not said how, and so it really made her question what exactly, you know, God's plan is, and that she indicates that the children always pay for the sins of the parents. Now, it's never gone into as to what this woman's sin is, but the mother of the two daughters, she is divorced, and it's indicated that Alice was born before she was married to the father. And so apparently, you know, obviously that's upsetting this devout woman, who still is, even though her daughter had died. So it comes out, obviously, that it's her. She ends up killing morbidly obese neighbor that's lives downstairs from them that was kind of, he's really creepy. He's like actually like trying to like keep Alice from leaving his apartment at one point, and very like with sexual overtones, like he's a molester. It was really creepy. But she ends up killing him because he catches her trying to get into Alice and her mom's apartment. So towards the end, she goes to church to try to get away. And so she's just sitting in church. She doesn't know that the police are after her. But the police know that now that she's in church, they're working with this Father Tom. And Father Tom convinces the police not to go in guns blazing, but that, you know, she wouldn't hurt him, and that let him kind of accompany her out of the church. So they reluctantly agree, saying that they'll have all the exits covered. And they start giving First Communion, and they get to her, and Father Tom says, you know, I can't give you communion at this point. You're going to have to come with me. You know, the police need you. And she starts losing it and calling that Alice's mom a whore, and just screaming it in church. And she pulls out her long knife and stabs Father Tom right in the neck. And so she, you know, he ends up dying. They manage to, the police come rushing in and get a hold of her. But you see Alice, that who was also at church, ends up grabbing the paper bag that the woman had and walking away. And like the last scene is just her like grabbing the long knife from the plastic bag and like kind of like looking at it, and then it just freeze frames. So I don't know if that's indicating that one is she now going to, you know, have something to do with murders? Did she have something to do with some but not all of the murders? It's really left unclear. But I thought the movie itself was pretty interesting, and I even though it took me a couple days to finally finish it, I enjoyed it. If you're looking for something, it's not super fast paced by any means. It's a slower paced, you know, like 70s type horror. Kind of like even like, you know, I guess a slasher movie. But I definitely would recommend checking it out.
Sounds cool. Sounds like it's just not as good as Christmas Vacation, but
no, probably not. I don't know how many deaths are in Christmas Vacation, but I would guess that this one has more. At least death by stabbing.
All right. Well, my pick is Sergeant Rock 358, which has a Joe Kubert cover, and he basically, they're underneath a Panzer tank, and it looks like Sergeant Rock's gonna get run over, and there's a bunch of kids with wooden guns. And he says, "Come back, you kids. This ain't no game. It's war." And it has an interesting opening because Sergeant Rock takes a, like, he's with, he has a tendency to go scout before his easy company because he doesn't want any of his own men getting killed. But he's the leader of them. He sort of walks out in front and takes a bullet to the head, but the bullet ricochets off his helmet, knocks him out cold, and then he's surrounded by a bunch of kids. One girl and the rest of them are boys, and they have these wooden guns, and one of the soldiers is leading them, and he says, "I'm the general, I'm the oldest." And they said all our parents were killed. They're taking Sergeant Rock back to where they're actually living, and they're attacked by one of those like Nazi trucks, but it's not a tank. They end up burying all their parents. Sergeant Rock is like, you guys need to leave. You can't fight this war with wooden guns. This is a war you cannot win." And then there's a plane that just comes by and it's ripping bullets all over the place. And Sergeant Rock destroys it with his machine gun. And he's like, "Well, I got to get these kids out of here." They take him to the fortress. They have like barrels full of apples and potatoes and cans of kerosene and wine bottles. And Sergeant Rock builds like these grenades out of the wine and kerosene and shows him how to light it. But he says, "You stay down here quick, I'll be right back." So he goes out there to fight a tank with this bottle, and they actually shoot the grenade before he can throw it, and he ends up like right before the tank, and then all of these kids come out with these grenades that Rock showed him how to build and just like bomb this tank and blow the shit out of it up. And they sort of save his life, and then he takes them back to camp and then takes them back to safety. But he's like, "Wow, these kids are hardened, and they'll never ever have a chance to be kids again." So it's a pretty depressing story, but there's nothing illuminating about war that makes you like, "Wow, this is exciting. This is death." And then
Mike, are
they.
you okay? Are you feeling all right?
Yeah.
Okay. You're reading all this depressing stuff. I was wondering if you were doing okay.
I like war comics right now. And then
I know, I'm just
the
kidding.
battle the there they have like a 2-page spread called the Bomb Disposal Unit. They do a lot of factual things, which actually show in Britain that they had like these Royal Engineers assigned a bomb disposal unit, and it shows you what their job was. They were essentially going to dismantle bombs that really never went off, like they hit a building.
Oh
And
yeah.
I guess that happened a lot. And
Yeah, in England and stuff.
yeah.
Yeah.
So a lot of bombs like would hit the building and they would just be hanging there. They never went off. So this bomb disposal unit would get dispatched and they'd go and dismantle all these bombs. The next story is called Deep Prey. This one's really interesting. It's a battle underwater with frogmen in underwater suits, and they are fighting with knives, and there's an American and a Nazi, and the Nazi kills the American, starts bleeding all over, and that blood draws sharks, and then the Nazi is killed to death by he's eaten alive by sharks. So it was kind of irony there. And then the fourth story is called King's Blood, which is sort of involves kids again, but the it's a battle between the Saxons and the Normans, and it shows a kid that's being picked on by a Norman knight, and he ends up becoming a knight later on, and then sees another kid and doesn't treat him like he was treated when he was a kid. So that was a pretty cool story. And then I always read the letters columns in these books. And one of these was fascinating because I would have never guessed a woman would read a war comic. And this letter is from Carol Pomplum. And it looks like she was from Illinois. And she said, "Dear sir, I found your Sergeant Rock volume 30, 349, The Dummy, and felt it was the saddest comic story I've ever read. I gave it to my husband, and he liked it so much that he told me to subscribe. He is not a comic book fan, so that is a very high praise." So I thought that was interesting because it's usually, at least most of the stories I know, it's the man showing the woman the comic book, not the inverse. And this is the wife getting her husband into comics through Sergeant Rock. Really
Yeah.
cool letter. That's all I had.
Okay, I just had one last one, as you
Is it
know.
Superman?
By this point, how did you guess?
We don't get to pick. We don't get to pick.
If you want, you can. Your choices are Superman, or Superman,
I'll
or
take
Super, or Superman.
the second one.
Second
Superman.
Superman.
Yeah.
Okay. This is from The Adventures of Superman by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez trade. And it is Superman issue 302. It was written by Elliot S. Magan. And
I like that guy's writing.
yes, called 7 Foot 2 and Still Growing. And it starts when Clark Kent wakes up. Well, he goes to sleep and then he wakes up. And when he wakes up, his jammies are torn at the seams and don't fit as well. Says, man, I must have been flexing my super muscles in my sleep. But then when he goes to put on his suit, his Clark Kent suit, he realizes that those don't fit him either, and that somehow he's grown a foot taller while he was asleep. Well, we find out that it's none other than Lex Luthor that's to blame. He's got a minion monitoring the situation, and letting him know that Superman went to sleep. Meanwhile, they've got a bunch of planning to do, that they're going to be some crimes that they're going to commit while Superman is dealing with this problem. And I like Lex Luthor, you know, pre-crisis, he's got his superpowers colors on. He's not in the battle suit, but he's got purple shirt and green pants. So Superman has some problems. He's not used to his new size, and he goes to deal with some smugglers on a ship outside Metropolis, and he causes a tidal wave to almost capsize the ship. He has to save the guys before they fall in the water because of the he wasn't expecting the splash that he was going to create. So it gets to the point where the Daily Planet is reporting on Superman, seems to have gotten bigger, that the smugglers that we saw him dealing with have reported that he was like 9 feet tall. Luther is quite pleased by this. It seems that he zapped him with a ray, which super activated his pituitary gland, and that's why he's growing like this. So Superman's having more and more problems the bigger that he gets. He normally flies in through the window of his apartment, and he tries to do that and knocks some of the wall out. He's like, well, I'll just have to make some Clark Kent clothes that'll fit my new size. And he's like, well, no, wait a minute. Why am I thinking? I can't walk around. Metropolis is a 9 foot tall Clark Kent. Why am I, so he knows he's starting to have trouble thinking straight. And so he ends up calling Ray Palmer because, he's the guy that he knows about changing sizes. And so Palmer comes through the phone line as he's wont to do as the Atom, and starts helping Superman out, and he gets a look at Superman's brain and says, the reason you're starting to have trouble thinking straight is that your brain isn't growing with the rest of you.
Well, that's a problem.
Yeah. Well, obviously he can't show up to work like this. So he calls Morgan Edge and he tells him, can you send a news van here? I've got a story lined up. And he convinces him to do that. And Steve Lombard, who is a character at Galaxy that Clark has a lot of problems with, he's a show-off and everything like that, he shows up and Palmer tries to take the keys from him for the news van. He said, I'm not handing the keys off to some random guy that, I don't know. He's like, all right, well, just, I'll take these up to his apartment. He's like, okay, well, actually he's just inside that garage door. Well, they get by with this because Lombard is thinking that, he's seeing things. When he spots a 9 foot tall Clark Kent. And, you know, he just thinks he's imagining things, and he runs off. So he sets up some cameras, and he does like a, and he interviews himself basically, and using his super speed, he goes from one chair to the other so fast, changing from Clark Kent to Superman, that it appears on television that Clark Kent is interviewing Superman. And they construct the set so that everything is large, and they build everything large so that when it's broadcast, it looks like they're normal size.
Normal size.
And he said, you know, the interview is basically, well, you can see that Superman's no taller than I am, and so the rumors about him growing to be 9 feet are just a, you know, just that, a rumor. So once they accomplish that, Superman flies Palmer back to Ivytown. And after they say hi to me, they then construct a helmet that will allow Superman to, well, they'll be able to communicate between the two of them while Superman heads out. Palmer's able to shrink his body, but it's going to take some time. While they're working on this, there's a report on the radio that Lex Luthor is going through and causing all these crimes. And so Superman can't wait for his body to shrink back down. So he puts on this helmet that they created and heads out. And Palmer's going to monitor through the helmet what's going on and help Superman, because Superman's really having a hard time like completing thoughts by this point. So that's what they do. And it works pretty well at first. And Palmer's telling Superman what to do. But Luthor is pretty smart himself, and he figures out that the helmet must be, somebody must be communicating through the helmet to Superman. So he manages to destroy the helmet, and that cuts off the communication with Palmer. So Superman's having some trouble here because he still can't think too well. So Luthor starts getting the upper hand on him. He's using like a personal flying device contraption and various different technological devices that he's developed to battle Superman. Once Luthor's gotten the upper hand, of course, all of a sudden Palmer hears a voice saying, you know, I've stopped all my bodily functions. This is Superman. I'm using my, here's another instance of him using super ventriloquism. He's using all his brain power to communicate. He's stopped all his bodily functions. So then Superman gets back up, and he started to shrink down a little bit this time. And so as he's flying Luthor away from the situation, his body's shrinking down. He brings Luthor to the set that they had created earlier for the fake news show. And to what it seems like to Luthor, Luthor feels like he's slowly getting bigger and bigger to match Superman's size. And so he freaks out and he deactivates the growth gland device. Apparently he can control it on his glove. Just as that happens, the TV set that is nearby explodes, and that knocks out Luthor. And Palmer comes out, and it seems like what they did was, or apparently what they did was that when Superman contacted Palmer, Palmer set it up with his, his usual shrinking and expanding stuff, his particles, he made it seem Superman was already shrinking because of the work that he had done, and Palmer made the set shrink around them. So really, Superman and the set were shrinking down to Luther's size, but Luther thought that he was actually growing taller and was being affected by the being infected by what he had infected Superman with, if that made any sense. So that's the
it does to me, because I had read this year.
Oh, okay. So yeah, it was actually a fun story. You know, Luther, just his kind of old criminal self, pre-crisis criminal self. And, you know, when I started the story, I didn't know that Ray Palmer was in it. So it was kind of, it was cool to see him show up and play a big part in the story. And it was goofy, but in a really, in an entertaining way.
I'll just say that Lombard is really classic in these 300 issues. Like, he's really good.
Yeah, he's a big,
he's kind a good of a character. Time, right?
So that was the last of mine.
Cool.
Rob, do you have anything else you wanted to wrap up with? Or?
Yeah, I wanted to read the whole 3-issue run, but I just ran out of time this morning. So I'll just mention, I read the first issue, so reread, because I have read this before. But I read the first issue this morning of We Three.
Oh, yeah.
From good old Grant Morrison and Frank Whiteley. So this is just really, this is just the first issue is really an introduction. Basically, the first several pages are a dialogue, free panels, where it's basically seeing the three animals. There's a dog, a cat, and a rabbit completing an operation. I don't know if it's terrorists, drug runners, or something else, but it shows the three of them taking care of business. And then after that, it goes on to they're back at base, at a military base, and you learn that the government is doing experiments, basically hooking up animals to cybernetics in an effort to use them for war and for these types of stealth operations to keep people from having to be killed for these types of things. And there's a U.S. senator that's there at the base to kind of take a look at everything. And the first thing that they show him are a whole colony of rats that can assemble a jet engine in 48 hours from spare parts. And it just shows them, you know, all working, doing different things, and very quickly getting things done. And then he asks to see the higher function animals, and that's when they take them to the three animals that are part of this story: the dog, the cat, and the rabbit. And there's the woman that's in charge of this is named Roseanne Barry. She's the doctor that basically has been involved in handling this project. And the senator is very surprised to see that the animals can actually do some basic talking. But in any case, for a reason that I'm not quite understanding here, is that apparently they have something else that they're going to be working on, and much to this female's doctor's dismay, this female scientist's dismay, they're decommissioning these three, and they're going to be replaced for Animal Weapon 4, and I don't remember what that is at this point. But the senator wants them to go ahead and basically put them out of their misery, is what he says. He assumes that they're that this is not, you know, a good situation for these animals, and they're not going to be used anymore, so they need to be put out of their misery. So you see, the next few pages are a lot of small panels that are like closed circuit TV monitors of just different things in the base, and it keeps following the female scientist, who basically has not clicked the button to keep the security, the restraint locks on the three animals. And you see her leaving, finally leaving the building. And then you see, after that, you see open, like an open jaw with fangs. And you see people being knocked over in these monitors. You see blood. You see a lot of other things going on. And sure enough, there's a full two-page splash of all three animals just running with just starlight in the background. They've escaped. So it shows what the government is trying to do to try to track them down. They're interviewing the female scientist, and you see the three animals just trying to figure out where to go next. The cat decides that it wants to stay out in the wild. The dog wants to go home. I'm assuming the home where, not the facility, but where it originally came from. And the dog and the rabbit go, and the cat ends up staying after having killed a bird out in the wilderness. And that's the end of the first issue. I'll be reading issue two or three later today. I wish I was able to have a chance before we talked, but I just ran out of time. But I've been meaning to reread this for years, and I finally thought I might as well do that today. It's only three issues, so
I've never read that one.
Oh, you haven't?
No, I haven't.
Like I don't
own it.
Me and you, we're very similar with Grant Morrison. I think there's some things that we both like, and maybe there's a few other things that we don't like as much. This is one that I really enjoyed at the time, and I haven't read it. And it came out in 2004, so I haven't read it in 14 years. So I wanted to give it a reread. Chris, you've read this before?
I don't remember if I did or not. I definitely remember it coming out, and it's like surprising to me that it's been 14 years.
Yeah, I know.
But I think I at least read an issue of it. I don't remember if I don't know if I read the whole thing or not.
Gotcha.
I don't remember it being only three issues.
Yeah. Yeah. It's got one. Each cover is a missing sign. Like, you know, you'd see it, you know, as you're walking the neighborhood on a post or something.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it highlights the dog asking for a reward, then the cat, and then the rabbit. So I could see, actually, Mike, you might not liking this as much, because it definitely is, you know, if I've only read the first issue so far, and I don't remember the other two. So it's not outright anything too disturbing, but it's definitely, you know, doesn't take into consideration, you know, an animal's best interest.
I always have a hard time, like, they can slaughter all kinds of people, but when there's animals, they have a rough time.
Yeah, like, and I don't remember exactly how this ends, but I think it's very bittersweet.
There's a dog in Walking Dead, and I'm like, God, I don't want them to hurt the dog.
Oh, yeah, dog.
Dog, yeah.
Yeah.
But that dog is awesome because he knows when to be quiet and he knows when to alert him. He's like, yeah. Dog! This season of Walking Dead is the best. I've just been on the edge of my seat, man.
Went into this season thinking this I would be very just, I don't know, so on it, because I knew that Rick was leaving.
Yeah.
Like, how are they really going to do a season you know, without the main character? And I was really down on it, and it really exceeded my expectations.
Oh, it's blown me away, man. It's really blown me away.
Yeah.
So
go ahead.
Last book is Men of War, number four. This is Gravedigger. So he's dealing with that. They're basically having to take out like this tank, this Nazi platoon that are embedded in a mountainside that are kind of bombing their camps pretty successfully. And they can't reach it with the planes because it's protected by the mountainside. So Gravedigger and his troops go there, and he has to go with this racist captain. He's a captain. Sorry, Gravedigger is the captain. The racist guy's a lieutenant, and he can't deal with the fact that he has to take orders from a black man. And he does some stupid things in this one. He gets a grenade, and he's going to throw it at the Nazis, but there's a bunch of fuel drums there. And Gravedigger has to knock the grenade away and actually protect them, or it would have killed them all. But when he's trying to save the lieutenant again, this is like the third time he's tried to save him, he's not successful. He gets shot a couple of times by Nazi gunfire, and then takes him over his shoulder and kind of takes him to safety where he can get him to the medics. And then these Nazis have him pinned inside the cave. But which are the stalactites and stalagmites? Which one's stalactites?
The tights
are the ones.
The tights are on the ceiling.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Stalactites. So he hits the stalactites on the ceiling and basically knocks out a bunch of Nazis. And then he finds the tank and finds a flamethrower, and he goes into the tube of the tank. He puts the flamethrower in the front end of the tank and just flames them so those guys cook inside of the tank. And then it has an interesting scene with I don't remember this guy, but he might have been introduced. He's like a major, and he's in a wheelchair, and he wants to go back into the front lines, and they won't let him. So he's having to deal with like suicidal thoughts because he doesn't know what to do with his life now that he can't go back to war. And that's just like a prelude. So Gravedigger essentially saves the day and then comes back to the camp where that racist lieutenant is just shouting at him, and he has to deal with it even though he's the superior officer. So looking forward to how that completes. I was expecting an Enemy Ace backup story, but it was a different type of a story. They had some interesting Ask the Answer Man things. I have always loved to read these things.
Me too. I probably read the same ones over and over again from different issues over the years, but I keep reading them anyhow.
Yeah, this one says, are Metamorpho, Zatanna, Plastic Man, Hawkgirl, Supergirl, and Red Tornado members of the Justice League? And he pretty much said, Hawkgirl and Red Tornado are full-time members. Metamorpho is a reserve. Zatanna is a stand-in by member. Supergirl does not belong. I don't know what he meant by that. It's kind of cruel. Plastic Man and Captain Marvel, who live on other Earths, are also not members. So, this question I don't understand. How come the 30th century, the Legion, and Iris Allen are not the same? What does that mean?
Remember when Iris Allen went to live in the future?
But what does he mean? How could he compare the Legion to Iris Allen?
I think they're saying that both in the 30th century.
Yeah, I think they're saying like, how come
they're not in the same
encounter each
it's
other?
Not the same.
Okay, yeah. They're not in the same era. Even though they're in the same era, they're not. Okay.
Yeah, maybe so they're different continuities.
His answer is they're along with the worlds of Commandy and the Star Hunters are alternate futures existing much like parallel Earths, which exist in the present.
Mm. There you go.
this thing I didn't even know existed. There was something called a Shazam Award, and somebody was asking, what is a Shazam Award? It's an award voted by the members of the ACBA for excellence for best story, best art, and best coloring. Something like an Eisner Award, I guess.
Interesting.
The last question is Claw coming back in the near future? And the answer was he should be back in 1978. I don't know if he came back because I'm only aware of the original series. And then I think he came back in the Wildstorm era as a Wildstorm property. but I read Claw. I own Claw, so that's pretty cool. And the next story is like a debut of a new type story. It's called Dateline Frontline. This one was pretty doggone cool because it deals with reporters. A U.S. reporter is going back to London to report on the war and work for the British as well to help them report on war stories. And he meets up with a reporter there, and a reporter just goes to the bar. He meets a bunch of people that actually fly in planes and gets a bunch of stories to write his article. And the American reporter says, "What the hell are you doing? You don't even have any factual information. They could just be bragging that they did these things." And he goes, "Well, these are the articles that help support the war. So if the enemy reads it, it looks like we're winning. If we read it, it improves morale." And the American reporter is like, "Well, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to tell the truth." So the next night, he's out there trying to find out, you know, whether they're getting bombed and stuff and trying to find out facts. And they're getting hit by a lot of bombs that night. And there's an anti-aircraft fire that the British are using. And they're, like, knocking down German planes. But in an effort to knock down the German planes, they knock down one of their own buildings and kill their own people because they're rotating the gun around, shooting at the plane, and they accidentally shoot the anti-aircraft gun at a building, which kills some, takes down the building and kills some of their own people. Well, he actually went to report the truth, and they didn't let him release his story because of the same reasons that they let the other reporter tell his story. Because they didn't want to hurt morale, and these guys are fighting for their lives, and yes, they made a mistake, but they didn't want the public to know about it. So it was a really interesting story. Mm. Yep.
Do you see the, you need that last issue of Men at War. Do you see that? What it is?
No, it's a crisis tie-in or what?
No, it says Gravedigger and Sergeant Rock in a full-length battle blockbuster. And Gravedigger saying, move out, easy, I'm taking over. And Rock is kind of lying on the ground, wounded.
Oh yeah,
he's still alive.
If you look up Gravedigger, he took over Easy Company for a short bit.
Interesting.
So that might be it.
Yeah, that's the final issue of Men of War.
I have the first 10 issues of Men of War, and as I go through and determine my next MyComicShop.com order, I have the next 20, and then I'll finish it off.
Yeah.
But that's what I'm doing. I really have been in this mood. That and Nightwing. I just marathoned through Nightwing, the latest series, and really enjoyed it. But I'm that mood guy, so who knows what I'm jumping off to next. Yeah. All right. Cool. Well, I think we're done here.
We've done our work.
We've done our work. So mm-hmm. if you want to compete in this challenge, if we do one more episode, if we can get together, I know Chris said you probably might not be able to make it before the holidays, but if we do pull something off for a Christmas episode, I will watch It's a Wonderful Life.
Okay, I'm already reaching out to friends and family to see if anyone owns Christmas Vacation, yeah. And if not, then I'll just rent it.
Okay. So that's the plan.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Do you have any Christmas movies you'd recommend, Chris? That's like your favorite Christmas movie?
I like Christmas Vacation, but Scrooged is another one I like to watch.
Oh, the Bill Murray one?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Any others?
Not any other ones that I haven't seen mentioned.
Okay.
I like Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas.
I've seen that once, and I don't remember it other than their Muppet type characters.
Yeah, they're Muppets, yeah.
Nice. I have never seen any of the old claymation stuff, but I used to love them. The Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and all that stuff. I
love that stuff. Yeah,
I used to eat that up. The hot guy and the fire guy, do you know which ones I'm
you
talking
got it.
About?
Oh, yeah. What Heat Miser and Cold Miser.
Yeah.
Miser. Yeah. That's the year without a Santa Claus.
Oh, that was awesome.
That's my favorite. Yep.
I loved that as a kid.
Me too.
That was my shit right there. I
The
like that
kids
one.
have seen that many times now. That and Rudolph, of course.
Yeah, that was my favorite though, more so than Rudolph.
Yeah.
Yeah,
That's fun.
Frosty the Snowman was pretty cool too.
Yeah, that was a good one. I don't think we've shown them that yet. We got to
Yeah.
do that.
All right, well, you can reach us at geekbrunchpodcast.com. At MythMakingETC. Woo! Woo! Celebrate! I got it. I remembered it.
I knew
That's
that
a
was coming.
robot dog face. At Mike Myers Brunch and at Rob Krieger. And you can send us stuff on the web page as well by clicking on the comments section, and on Facebook by going to Geek Brunch Podcast, where all the episodes are kept there. I want to thank you guys, and if I don't talk to you, which I'm pretty sure I will, whether it be on IM or whatever, have a happy holiday.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
All right, have a good one, guys.
Thanks,
You guys
guys.
enjoy the rest of your
Okay.
Sunday. Bye.